Recently, we overheard at the city of Phoenix in Arizona. During the time there, we gave two discourses that were recorded, each over an hour in length. The material that is being about is contrary to many statements found in literature. It could even be regarded as heretical. It bears upon the problem of redemption and involves a redefinition of what is meant by redemption from not only the Christian point of view, but from even the point of view of the Advaita Vedanta and of traditional Buddhism. The ordinary Christian conception is that if an individual entity attains to the state of the heavenly world, he has been redeemed. That is here challenged. And for these reasons, the heavenly world, as well as the hell worlds and this world here, are phenomenal. The phenomenal order is an order in which the presence of objects, subtle or gross, is preeminent and often even dominant. Thus, if one were a good man and attained beyond this life to a heavenly world, he would be in a domain, according to the current conceptions, of a phenomenal order, but presumptively a pleasant phenomenal order, where there were experiences of apparent objects. If, on the other hand, he had a karma that led to a painful after-death state, we'd say he passed through a hellish world. The conception is that the experiences, whether in a heavenly world or in a hellish world, are proportional to causes set up during life here. And since those causes are finite, the results can only be finite. There is a limited time of hellish experience, and there is a limited time of heavenly experience. And then one circles back to ordinary embodied life here in this world, to experience again and to strive again, and perhaps earning other painful experiences in after death, or other delightful experiences after death. It is the present thesis that this condition, whether of the pleasant kind or the painful kind, is a non-liberated, a non-redeemed condition. Goodness is not enough, nor is belief in the efficacy of any person, however exalted, enough to achieve the redeemed or liberated condition. More is involved. More advanced religious thought has held the view But to be liberated or redeemed is to attain a nirvanic state. This is more nearly akin to true liberation or redemption. But inasmuch as a nirvanic state can be a shut-in or closed experience, where one cannot move out of the nirvanic state at will, it is the present thesis that this too is less than full redemption. The full redemption, in fact, requires the attainment of a state in which one can move at will between the worlds of experience, or samsara, and the nirvanic world, which consists of a consciousness which is not phenomenal, but is pure. That the movement shall be at will between the two, and that therefore an individual actually abides in a state more transcendent than nirvana, the one which has been called para nirvana, which I have identified, at least tentatively, with that state of consciousness previously called the high indifference. Now that it is true that heretofore the two states of external experience are samsara and the state of nirvana have been mutually exclusive, is accepted as a partial truth, a truth heretofore. If therefore we take a position that appears contrary to that in Buddhist and Vedantist and Christian teaching, there is no repudiation of the validity of these three, but rather the maintaining that these are steps that represented the extent to which realization or attainment was possible at the time when these unfoldings were put forth, and that something more becomes possible today because of that which has been built or performed heretofore. We view this present step as another structure or addition to the total structure of revealed truth that becomes possible because of the building of those who preceded. There is therefore no conflict. But there is a difference of philosophic view implying that truth that can be made manifest is relative to the stage of development in consciousness at the time. Further, it is affirmed that no absolute truth, unconditional, unrelated to the relativity of time and space, can be formulated. But these ideas that have been recently advanced are important, as not only the support of my own personal conviction but even more emphatic support from certain others. Irma, for one, has given it even more emphatic importance than I have. A certain communication which Lillian received and which was authenticated by Irma has given it a still more radical importance. And at the time that we were down in Phoenix, on one occasion, someone spoke through Irma in most emphatic terms. There has been, however, a problem in connection with the bringing forth of this knowledge, which is related to a certain critical position. Between the state of realization known to me first on August 7th, 1936, in the ascension to the state of consciousness, there was a certain critical point which I have called a point of discontinuity, in which there was an inversion of consciousness. An important characteristic of that inversion was that whereas in the ordinary state the self seemed to be like a point, a sort of center, with an environment around it, namely the environment of the whole universe. On the other side of the point of discontinuity, the self seemed to be like a sphere which embraced the whole universe. There's obviously an incompatibility between these two perspectives. The problem is the integration of them. Without the integration, if one side is to be identified with a nirvanic state of consciousness and the other with a samsaric state of consciousness, the point of discontinuity would imply that the two shall not meet. And that may be the reason why all the literature, ordinary literature at any rate, on the subject implies that one is either a samsari or a nirvani, but not both. And because of that, those who chose to become instruments or agents for effecting redemption of humanity, if they attained to the possibility of a nirvanic consciousness, were urged to renounce it, thereby abandoning the dharmakaya robe and taking the nirmanakaya robe. It was an either or proposition. Now what is suggested here is that it is possible to bridge the point of discontinuity. And if that point of discontinuity is bridged, an interflow between the samsaric state of consciousness and the nirvanic becomes in principle possible. And that rendering this possible is a preeminently important contribution to the problem of redemption. Way back in 1936, I did have the experience of seeming to be on both sides of that point of discontinuity. It was an unpleasant state, and I then evolved the figure to suggest it of a man standing with one foot on one world and the other foot on another world, and that the two worlds were rotating in opposite directions. In the physical sense, an impossible position, but not therefore impossible in the psychical sense. Nonetheless, it was a very unpleasant state, actually involved in agony, and was so reported. But in time, the position becomes tolerable, and even ultimately delightful. It is my thought that bridging this gulf caused by the point of discontinuity a direct intercourse between the samsaric and the nirvanic zones becomes possible. Now, the definition of the nirvanic state we have had heretofore has been in the nature of release, of rest, of withdrawal from the field of action. What is now suggested is that that is not the whole of the story. That there is a force, a dynamism in the nirvanic field of consciousness. Something that we have already called the current. That this has a value of refreshment. But it also has a value as a transforming agency. That it tends to transform the state of consciousness of him who contacts it, even though his contact is merely that of the threshold of nirvana. I know that it tends to melt the hardnesses in one, that it tends towards inclusiveness, toward a feeling of an underlying sweetness in the very heart of all that is. Now, let us suppose that something of this dynamic consciousness could be intermitted into the samsaric field. Not now thinking in terms merely of leading one individual here and another there to that state of realization where they could enter nirvana, but thinking in terms of bringing nirvanic value into the samsaric field with its transforming effects. How would that be a help? In answer to this question, let us look forth upon the condition of samsara as we find it in this world. I won't pretend to say anything about samsara as it is elsewhere. But Sankhara, as we find it in this world, is a domain of many, many problems that seem essentially insoluble. History is a story of man's inhumanity to man in many ways. And even the efforts of the men of goodwill so often bring not good for people. Efforts fail to resolve the problem. If we can look back, say, 5,000 years, can we say that in the essential moral and spiritual sense that the world today is any better than it was? To be sure, technically, it's far advanced as compared to what it was. But technology solves none of the essential problems. None of the moral problems, none of the spiritual problems as such. Man, through his technology and through his skills, has brought about a condition in which he could today render all life impossible in this world. And we live with the danger that grows out of man's impurity and yet possession of such power. These were threatened again by an explosion of population that may result in a so breaking down of the ecology of this world that maybe life ultimately would become impossible because we could not produce what's necessary to live. We can see the problem, many do, but we seem to be unable to solve it. We seem only to change it in one form, to have it reappear again in another form. But it's the same old problem. It occurs to me that what's needed in this humanity is a certain transformation at the very base of consciousness itself, of the human consciousness itself, so that instead of the misresults that come from all effort, there may be progress toward a real solution to the problems of humanity. And I see that transforming force in the very substance of the nirvanic consciousness itself. And that if it could flow in to the samsaric state, then men could become rapidly or slowly so transformed that the impossible problems become possible ones. And samsara itself would be redeemed. Then instead of a goal of departure from samsara, which certainly would seem to be the implication of the Buddhist sutras and of the Vedantic teachings of Shankara and of the teachings of Christ, who said, "My kingdom is not of this world." Instead of viewing the problem of redemption as an ultimate abandonment of samsara by all creatures, we would have a transformed samsara that would be relatively real, a valuable playground for consciousness in its evolutionary progression. So what I'm speaking of is not simply the redemption of individuals here and there, one at a time, a process that has been too slow. We would effect a redemption of the whole state of samsara and of its whole life. And that we would have massive effects, such as are needed in this emergency. And that the life of the future would become an interplay consciously, more and more consciously, between the samsaric and the nirvanic zones. Now, one thing that I was delighted to hear over at Phoenix was one day when Irma was speaking about things not ordinarily spoken of. And I think I'm justified in saying this much, that this conception of nirvana is to be found in the fourth volume of the Secret Doctrine. That the total picture we have known heretofore in the literature is only partial and far from complete. The critical point in all of this is a problem of effectuation. I have advanced ideas. Usually, though, there's a difference between an idea and the effectuation of an idea. In our world as we live today, the two functions are carried on by different individuals. On one side, the knowers. On the other side, the effectuators. In our business, in our government, and so on, the knowers are those that we classify as scientists, scholars, engineers. The effectuators are the practical politicians and managers of businesses. Effectuation is primarily an act of will. The other side, the ideational side, is a matter of knowledge. I've been outlining a pattern of knowledge. That's not enough. But not always is the separation between idea and effectuation absolute. He who speaks in the current also effectuates. But there's another aspect to it, and that is the crossing of that gulf represented by the point of discontinuity. And this calls for those who will choose when they are able. It takes a while to become able. To abide in a field of consciousness which is partly samsara and partly nirvana, refusing to accept neither side exclusively. And that means that they cross the point of discontinuity. That in a certain sense may be said that they're balancing on a razor's edge between one side and the other. It's a balancing act in one sense. It does permit, as I see it, a being more in the nirvanic state at some times and more in the samsaric state at other times, but never completely in either. And that the more people, more individuals, who, having reached the point where they may take this position, choose to do so, the more does it become possible for the inflow of nirvanic consciousness into the samsaric field with its transforming, rejuvenating, and refreshing power. And that then more and more will we advance toward that massive redemption which is the need of the day and which means the redeeming of samsara as a state of consciousness as well as of the individual entities that abide in samsara. Now that's an outline of what I've been saying over the past several weeks. It has been said heretofore, this is an abstract of it. But there's some other thoughts now tentative. I present them as suggestions. There is, in the so-called third volume of the Secret Doctrine, not the true third volume, that was part of the third edition of the Secret Doctrine, under the heading of the Mystery of Buddha, a certain discourse of the Buddha that was headed a hitherto unpublished discourse of the Buddha, in which the Buddha is represented as saying that there are three things that are real. These are nirvana, the law, and akasha. And that these three reduce to one, akasha, which to the ordinary consciousness is maya, but in reality is the sole true reality. Now akasha, we are told, as a record of all that has ever happened or transpired in this world, that nothing ever vanishes. One's first impression when dealing with a word like record is to think of something like a moving picture, or an auditory recording. Therefore, something that is not alive. That's not, we have reason to believe, the true picture of the Akashic Record. But on the contrary, the Akashic Record is the living reality itself. The life that was lived not only with its sense impressions and thoughts, but with all the force of its feelings as well. Therefore, reading the Akashic Record is, in fact, a living over again of that which was once lived and mayhap also of that which to us now appears to be in the future. This is a suggestion only. But the basis for the suggestion is this. Time is not an absolute. It appears here in the samsaric world as a tyrant, but the nirvanic state is both timeless and spacious. That tyrant does not exist there. It appears here as though we were separated inevitably and unequivocally from everything of the past, and that the possibilities of the past that were not used are lost forever, and that therefore time is tragic, as Spengler himself maintained it was. But if the view of time which we have, namely of a stream flowing from the past to the future, and as we sail down that stream, we're separated from the past and know not the future. If that figure is false, and that rather time may be likened unto a lake, in which the ripples are the time, namely the time being enclosed by a consciousness that is more comprehensive, that there is no radical separation of past from the present and of the future from the present, but this is merely a device for experience or development that has no absolute reality, then the past still lives, and also the future, it would appear to be, is equally now. The suggestion has come to me that by taking our base of reference in the nirvanic consciousness, we would find ourselves equally close to that which is distant in space and time as compared to that which is near in space and time. And that from that position, then, it would be possible to live again in the past, or perhaps in a sense to live on in the future. It would appear, too, that memory of past lives, in the complete sense, participating them in full detail, would be a form of Akashic reading, particularized form, not the broader form in which you read the history of the whole human race or participate in the history of the whole human race or of the geology of the world, but a particular form that is more accessible to the reason, that is closer to us individually. A picture rose in my mind in connection with this thought, and here I'm giving only a suggestion, but consider it. Suppose we call our present life apparent real time, and if we call the time of the Akashic record, where you have an experience of process also, apparent Akashic time. Not to suggest that the conception is adequate or complete, but just to distinguish between the two. And I use the word apparent to indicate that the conception is tentative. Suppose in the apparent real time, as we imagine our present state to be. One were to put himself into a state of Sarvikalpa Samadhi and project himself back into a life of the past. And he proceeds to find himself living in another day, sensing and thinking and feeling. All of the pains and the delights of that life, with all the force of reality that we know in our lives in apparent real time. But there is a witness that knows this is a reliving of something of another day. That witness, self, while present, is not confused by its experience. But now suppose that something obscured the witness self, and you found yourself in apparent Akashic time, living a life, and knew of no other life than that life. You might be caught in it. You might be living it through until you die. Then the question arises, how do we know that we are now living in apparent real time and not in an apparent Akashic time? Have all the lives that we are living been lived over before? Are we just moving over an endless recurrence of lives that have been lived before? Just circling round and round and round. This is a question. Possibility, I see, that a person who penetrates into Akashic time might find himself locked in to a life that has already been lived and be simply living over again. Then I got to the point where I was on the edge of concepts I couldn't capture, where all seemed to be, and all at once, the beginning and the end of a mantra, present now, and the thought I couldn't think, I couldn't get a word or a symbol for it, just nature. So I'm leaving this for you to mull over and ask yourself the question, do I know for sure that I'm living in apparent real time a life that is new, whose future is not determined? Or am I mistakenly living over another life that I've lived before in Akashic time? Because I permit the witness self to become obscured. Now, with that unpleasant thought, I would close.